Good evening, everybody. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Tova Kelman Gutenberg, and on behalf of my family, we want to welcome everyone here tonight as we commemorate tonight and tomorrow the fourth yahrzeit of our beloved father, Harav Chaim Yosef ben Harav Tzvi Yehuda, and last week we marked the 14th yahrzeit of our mother, Rachel Bat Chaim. In the years since our parents' passing, we have been blessed with the birth of grandchildren, and there have been great-grandchildren born who bear the names of my parents, and we have much to be grateful for. My own sons, Baruch Hashem, are carrying on the family tradition, and we will be the 10th generation of rabbis, and my sons will be graduating from the same school as my father did, Yeshiva University. The mitzvah of kibud av va'em, honoring one's parents, does not apply only while they are alive, but continues even after they have physically left this world. Tonight's program, entitled Beyond Labels, Can't We All Get Along, is especially fitting as a tribute to my parents, who got along with everyone they met and treated all with dignity and respect. My father especially saw beyond labels and worked tirelessly on behalf of the special needs children and young adults in our community, giving them a voice and a place to express their Jewish identity. The impact that my father, together with my mother's support, had on the community at large was immense, and his wisdom and counsel are sorely missed. My parents' love and genuine concern for everyone they met is an attribute we should all seek to emulate. We miss their insight, their common sense, and advice, and hope and pray that we can pass on to our children and grandchildren the values and midot that they held so dear. It now gives me great pleasure to call upon Rabbi Daniel Korobkin to say a few words. He is the Mora D'Atra of the BAYT Synagogue, of which we have been proud members for the past 25 years. We are all benefiting from his enthusiasm and dedication since his arrival in Toronto 2 years ago. Rabbi, please.
Thank you so much, Tova. And I can only reflect upon all the amazing things that I've heard about your father and your mother. They represent, I think, to this community a time when life in the Jewish community was a lot simpler, when things were less complicated, when there were fewer factions, and because the community was younger and smaller, everyone figured out how to get along. And it was in that context that your father and his Rebbetzin were able to accomplish so much for the Jewish community. And truly we can say, Chadesh Yomeinu Kikedem. Please, Hashem, give us an opportunity to recapture that sense of innocence and that sense of unity once again, so that we don't feel like we're not even sometimes communicating with each other. Ironically, sometimes it takes time to learn how to communicate. Even though we look back at a time when life was simpler, in this week's parsha, we read about how Moshe's mistake was not properly communicating. And the commentaries ask a very simple question, which is that there are two episodes in the Torah where God instructs Moshe to extract water from a rock. The first time is shortly after they left Egypt, and there Hashem explicitly instructed Moshe to strike the rock. But now, 40 years later, Hashem tells Moshe to extract water, and he expects Moshe to understand that they should speak to the rock and not to strike it. Moshe doesn't understand this lesson, and as a result, he cannot lead the Jewish people into the promised land. And of course, why does God change his position? There are a number of commentaries who discuss this, and it seems like the consensus is that sometimes you need to mature a little bit in order to be able to understand how to have a civil conversation. Sometimes when we let our Yetzer Hara get the best of us and we act in an immature fashion, Sometimes we become violent even in the way that we communicate with each other, and the result is unfortunate. The result is unhappy, and the result doesn't please anybody. The important thing is that over the course of 40 years, the Jewish people matured. They were able to understand that in order to exist and be consolidated as a people, it wasn't the staff and the threat of violence that was going to keep them together, but it was their ability to speak to each other, to communicate with each other. And that's what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted the Jewish people to understand, that if even you can talk to a rock and it can listen and give forth water, then every single Jew should be capable of communicating with every other Jew. And we should be able to open up, and we should be able to share with each other, and be able to at least understand, even when we can't disagree. And that's why we're here tonight, to be able to reflect upon where we are today and how we can make life even better for Klal Yisrael and do better. Accompanied by Mr. Mori Kelman, who's the moderator for the discussion tonight, I want to express a tremendous hakaras hatov to be able to be part of an evening with both Rabbi Shaffrin and Rabbi Golden, two people whom I greatly admire. First of all, I just want to point out that I would not be here, I would not be alive today if it wasn't for Agudas Yisrael. I would not be alive today if it was not for the organization Agudas Yisrael. You see, my mother was on the kinder transport, and there was a rabbi named Dr. Solomon Schoenfeld who enlisted the aid of Agudas Yisrael in order to save my mother and 1,000 other Orthodox children from the ravages of the Nazis from Austria and from Germany. Agudas Yisrael saved my mother's life, and therefore I'm here as a result of the good graces of Aguda. That doesn't necessarily mean that I always have to agree with Agudas Yisrael, but it certainly means that I have a tremendous hakaras hatov to Agudas Yisrael and a tremendous amount of respect for the great work that they are doing. And Rabbi Golden is a man who I have admired ever since I was before my bar mitzvah, when he was the assistant rabbi of Rabbi Lamb at Beth Jacob of Beverly Hills, where I grew up. And Rabbi Golden is now the president of the Rabbinical Council of America, an organization of which I proudly serve as a member and as an officer. And we are having our upcoming convention in just a few weeks, and Rabbi Golden has been very, very, is working assiduously in making this organization do its job and serve its members. But at the same time, both of these men, in their very intelligent and articulate fashion, work on behalf of Klal Yisrael to unite us all. And that's why I can't think of a better panel than these two distinguished gentlemen, these two distinguished rabbis, to discuss how we can even communicate better, how we can get along, and how we can live together as ki ish echad b'lev echad. And therefore, without further ado, I thank you, and here is our panel. Thank you.
Thank you very much, both Rabbi Karopkin and my sister Tova. As you both alluded to and even went to a little detail, things have changed in the Jewish community, the Orthodox community, in the last number of years. When my grandparents came here in the late 20s, early 30s from Europe, my grandfather was a rav in Toronto of many different shulos. He died, unfortunately, very young. And when my mother grew up, a few years after my father, she also comes from an Orthodox family, one of the few Orthodox families really in Toronto. And well, there was issues back then for anybody who knows the Toronto Jewish community, but it was, in a sense, a very simpler time. People did generally get along better. It was a smaller community. And as my sister said, what the home that we grew up with comes really is a home where the idea of talking to one another, of tolerance for one another, of really accentuating the positive, was at the forefront of our upbringing. And for that reason, as you know, many of you know, we've had different speakers over the last number of years, but this really, I think, is not only extremely timely in terms of what's going on in the Orthodox world and the infighting that, unfortunately, almost on a daily basis we see, especially in the last couple of months in Israel, as we'll get to, and other places and here as well. So I think it's very apt and very appropriate that we sit down together. And really, I don't want to give labels to anybody sitting here. Every Jew is a Jew, hopefully we try to have as many Jews be as observant as possible. That's what we should be focusing on, and that's really the purpose here, is try to begin a conversation among, as Rabbi Karapkin said, two of the major leaders in the Orthodox community these days, Rabbi Golden, the president of the RCA, a shul rabbi in Englewood, one of the leading Orthodox communities in America, a shul of about 700 families. His name is well known. He's written wonderful svarim on the Parsha, on Chumash. He's still in the process of doing that, I think, to try to finish all of Chumash. President of the RCA, the biggest Orthodox rabbinical organization in the world. And Rabbi Shafran, who is really, besides his official position as the spokesman of Aguda, of the Aguda Yisrael, he is, many of you, I'm sure, have read his columns, which are syndicated around the world in Cross Currents and Ami, and other Mishpacha, various magazines, and he really writes with tremendous passion and wit. You can read a lot of his articles, I think, also at rabbiavishafran.com, if you want to take a look at that as well. He's written books as well. It's all in the angles. It's really, we're looking forward tonight. I'm going to stop here in terms of the introduction, because we really want to get to a substantive conversation together about some of the major issues. The format, just very briefly, will be, we have a number of different questions. Each of the rabbis will answer for about 45 minutes. They'll each have a chance to respond to any of those responses, and then we will continue on, and then at the end of the formal part, we will open up and they'll give a summation of what they think are some of the major challenges in Orthodoxy today, and then we'll open up the forum to questions from the crowd. We encourage you to ask difficult questions, and this really is hopefully for the achdut of the Jewish people, and again, as we hope, this will begin a conversation that will continue not just in Toronto, but really beyond as well. So our first question of the evening is really to, if we can define somewhat, going beyond labels, the question is whether we put too much emphasis on defining who is frum, who is an Orthodox Jew, whether we sometimes look too much at the chitzonius of somebody who, as what I call, is externally religious, but maybe has other issues internally when it comes to other very important aspects of Judaism, of Ben Adam Lechavero, of Din Lemachut Adina, for example, as opposed to somebody who may be somewhat deficient in some of the rituals, but because he externally doesn't necessarily look the part, but in other areas he does wonderful things, we don't look upon him as Orthodox. So just really, are we basically too concerned with labels and not accentuating the positive enough in this day and age? So I'll start maybe with Rabbi Shafran.
Thank you. Before I even attempt to answer the question, which is a hard one, I want to thank everybody for being here. Most importantly, I'd like to thank the Kelman family for arranging this. This is a wonderful gathering, and I understand it's one of many each year, and a fitting event in memory of the parents, and should be very thankful that the family undertook this. And again, I thank you all for showing up. I do believe that the labels, all labels, are essentially inventions, and the word Orthodox is a label that actually was originally put upon Jews who considered Torah to be important by people outside of that community, so it's not a label that we necessarily need to preserve in any way. I try not to use it because it's lost a lot of meaning, and it also doesn't say much. So I think I'd rather assign a meaning to what a good Jew is or what a believing Jew is rather than use the label Orthodox. I think that there's no question that superficialities are not indicative of what lies in a person's heart and in his soul. This goes in both directions. A person might seem to be very firm, as the term goes, and as we've seen many times over the years, the person in no way reflects in his actions and in his attitudes, for that matter, what a Jew is supposed to believe and to do. And on the other hand, there may be a person who superficially doesn't seem to be very observant, and yet I would consider the person to nevertheless be an exemplary member of Klal Yisrael. What matters to me, and it's sort of turning on its head what many people feel, is that the way you live is what matters, not necessarily what you believe. I believe that it's the opposite. What a person's commitments are what define him or her as a Jew. none of us is perfect, and all of us make mistakes. And other main tzaddik ba'aretz, and there are things that that we may do that we are not proud of after we do it. That's why we have Yom Kippur each year. So I don't think that necessarily our actions per se define us. Even if we go to davening every day and we light candles every Shabbos and we're careful with this and careful with that, that doesn't necessarily mean that we have accepted, and this is what I think the crux of the matter is, accepted the Torah as our guide. That sounds trite, but what I mean to say is, are we willing to bend our will, at least in theory, to the will of the Torah, to the will of Halacha? And bending one's will means doing something that one doesn't want to do. It even might mean taking on an attitude that is not one's natural attitude. It might mean undertaking a point of view, or at least acting on that point of view, even if it is not our natural inclination to have that point of view. One might want to be a universalist, and yet there's a certain particularism in Judaism. And if a person, even if a person isn't successful in bending his will to that, or a person might be a feminist and feel that women's roles have to change, they feel that very deeply and sincerely. And there's nothing wrong with feeling that. But when it comes down to an actual acceptance of the Torah's roles, if a person rejects that and says, well, the Torah's role is not something that I can accept myself, that person is putting himself or herself outside the circle of Jews who, again, I don't want to put labels on it, but Jews who are machshiv Torah, who give Torah importance. There was a physicist, a famous physicist by the name of I.I. Rabi. Some of you may have heard of him. He's not as famous as Einstein, but he lived around the same time, a little bit earlier. And he was totally non-religious, from a rabbinical family, hence his name. And he was once asked by a biographer what his religion is. And he said, I'm an Orthodox Jew in the sense that that's the religion I don't practice and the synagogue I don't go to, which is an interesting idea. And I think, I'd like to think, I don't know what he meant, but I think what he meant, or he may have meant, is that recognizing the Torah supremacy, even if one cannot bring oneself to necessarily live entirely within the confines of what the Torah says, that itself is a very valuable thing. And none of us can judge another person. That's God's role. But on the other hand, all of us can know that, can recognize that sincerity in this nekuda, in this point, is, I think, the most important definition of a good Jew. Namely, do we accept the Torah's will even when it grates against our own? Nasa v'nishma is really what that alludes to. I'll stop talking now to let someone more erudite take over.
Before commenting, I also want to just bring up a little historical tidbit. Rabbi Karapkin mentioned that I was the rabbi when he was young. The first rabbi that I had who affected my life was Rabbi Abraham Kelman, who is the brother of the man who we are remembering today. So it's another small tidbit about how lives intertwine and how people play roles and change people's lives. It so happens that I agree almost totally with Rabbi Shafran in terms of what he just said, but I would like to perhaps hammer it home a little bit and maybe take it in a little bit of a different direction than he said as well. How do we're not God, it's not up to us to judge whether someone is a good Jew or a bad Jew, but if someone were to ask me what some of the criteria that I believe HaKadosh Baruch Hu will judge us by. So those criteria include, yes, bending our will to halacha, determining what the law is, understanding that there is a higher force and that it is not up to us to determine the course of our actions and our lives. But I would also say that there are other elements to Yahadut that we haven't been paying as much attention to and have to be paid attention to as well. One of those is, how concerned am I about all Jews? How much am I poresh min hatzibor and how mu'urav im hatzibor am I? How intertwined with the community am I? We're going to talk later about the unaffiliated and those beyond our borders. Are we concerned about that? Is that something that affects our lives? Because the Rambam and others have said very clearly that you can technically obey all the other commandments, but if we are not part of the community at large, if we're not concerned about all and actively trying to determine how we can be involved with all, then that's an issue for us. The other piece that I would just add is that there are two comments that have been very important for me. One of them I always said jokingly after I became a rabbi, and that was after meeting a number of people and seeing what they believed and what they did, is I said, you can't judge Judaism by the Jews. And what I mean by that is, how much of what we say and what we do that we purport to be Judaism is actually Yahadus? How much of it is actually Judaism? How much of the philosophy, how much time do we spend trying to determine what the philosophy of our tradition is, what we really believe about areas and concerns that go beyond the technical observance of our tradition? And I'll give you an example from my own experience that was very, very striking. I was at my nephew's bar mitzvah, and the rabbi who was speaking to my nephew turned to him and said, and I remember it so clearly, it was Parshas Vayera, and he said, why was the Akedah so special? What was so unique about Akedas Yitzchak? He said, Chaim, my nephew's name was Chaim, people have been willing to sacrifice their children to all sorts of things across the ages. The Romans sent them out to battle. He said, the difference is the difference between a Jewish child and a non-Jewish child. Avraham was willing to sacrifice a Jewish child. When the others sacrifice their children, it's not that significant. It's not that important. And I sat there. And what bothered me more than anything was that out of 250 people sitting there, I think I was the only one bothered. What is our attitude towards the non-Jewish world? What do we claim Judaism thinks about that attitude? These are the kinds of questions that we should be exploring, we should be asking. Because what I'm concerned about is that often when we think we're perpetuating Judaism, it's not Judaism that we're perpetuating. It may be Judaism on a technical level, but it's not Judaism on a philosophical level. And these kinds of questions, these kinds of issues, what does HaKadosh Baruch Hu want from us, is a wonderful question to ask. But then we really have to spend time going back to our tradition to determine what it really is that he wants from us. And those are difficult questions to answer.
Rabbi Shapiro, any response to...
I think you should ask the question that we can disagree.
Yeah, we're waiting for
much more like so picking up on the issue of bending our will. So one of the areas that has courted controversy and that has, I think, divided people within the self-defined Orthodox world is the question of Das Torah, right? The question of our gedolim, however we identify who our gedolim, who our leading rabbinic leaders are. How much fidelity do we have to give to them? Are they all-knowing when they proclaim something within halacha, with beyond halacha, and politics and other areas? Do we have to listen to them 100%? Can they make a mistake? And if they can make a mistake, then how do we respond to that? So just to give, Rabbi, we'll begin with Rabbi Golden here on your take on this issue of Das Torah, whether it's a new issue, whether it's an old issue. Some claim it's really a more of an invention in terms of the way that it's being used in the last number of years.
Right. I think you have to divide in the question into two areas. Are Chachamim infallible when it comes to the world of halacha? And are they infallible when it comes to issues and concerns that are perhaps outside of that technical world? And let me explain what I mean. When it comes to the world of halacha, the answer is the Chachamim are not infallible. They are not. However, HaKadosh Baruch Hu makes a deal with us. And that deal is that whatever decision is made within the halachic current and within the halachic context, as long as those who make that decision were loyal to the tradition and tried to reach the ultimate truth, HaKadosh Baruch Hu accepts that decision, and that becomes halacha. And that's why we can say, for example, that's why the Gemara can say, Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel, Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim chayim. How's it possible? Beis Shammai says it's treif, Beis Hillel says it's kosher. How could they both be right? Because the definition of right within the halachic context is no longer the same as it is in the rest of the world. The definition of right within a halachic context is, were you loyal to the tradition? Did you try to reach the truth? Did you try to determine God's will? And as long as you did so with all the efforts that you can muster, then HaKadosh Baruch Hu will say that whatever the halacha is decided, that is the halacha he will accept. Lo bashamayim hi. There are numerous places in the Gemara that seems to indicate this. It is simply a way where HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives divine law over to the hands of man and allows them to make the decisions. And if one looks at Rav Moshe Feinstein Zatzal's introduction to his Igros Moshe, you find that he says this. He says, I don't want to take on myself this responsibility. I don't want to have to decide, but one thing sets me at ease. And that is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu promises me that whatever I decide within a halakhic context, as long as I have done my best and tried to reach the truth, that is the halacha we accept. So that to me would be the definition of Das Torah within a halakhic context, which is the right of the Rav based upon his erudition, based upon his effort to determine the truth within the context of Jewish law. What happens, however, when a question comes up where expertise in the area is outside the purview of the rabbi? And here I can only talk from a context and from a viewpoint of my own teachers and my own upbringing. Rav Salvechik Zatzal, and more recently, an interface that I had with Rav Lichtenstein, Sheyivadet L'chaim. A number of years ago, I was involved, as I was speaking about with Rabbi Shafran on the way here in Israel, issues concerning Israeli politics, etc., and questions that came up concerning the security of the land of Israel and whether you were allowed to cede land. I don't want to get involved in the politics now. And I remember Rav Lichtenstein saying, we can determine the halachic parameters, but the key security issues, the issues as to whether this particular act on the part of the state of Israel will save Jewish lives or will not save Jewish lives, that is not within my purview. For that, I will go to the generals. For that, I will go to the experts. For that, I will receive information from those who are immersed in that world. And then, from a halachic context, I will tell you. I will tell you, for example, if this is the decision that you make halachically, for example, that one can cede land to save Jewish lives, that's my halachic decision. Now go to the generals and determine what the reality is. So to my mind, to extend Das Torah to those areas outside of the halachic experts' expertise is something that I find alien to my thinking. Go to the experts, determine the facts, then ask for halachic decision based upon that expertise. That is using the elements of our law in the way that they were meant to be used.
I think I disagree, though. I'm not quite sure I understand fully what you're okay. saying. So let me present what I believe is the point of view that a Jew should have. And I don't know that it in any sense contradicts what you said, but maybe you can clarify one point for me afterwards. I don't think that Das Torah is an invention. It was called Emunas Chachamim. Maybe the phrase Das Torah was an invented one, but the concept of going to the religious leaders, those who are most steeped in Torah and in a righteous life, which is a very important thing to add, who are not just steeped in the knowledge of Torah, but in the living of Torah, the way it's supposed to be lived, that is ancient. The Gemara is full of cases where when the community was facing either halachic or political challenges or social challenges, that the arbiters of what was right and what was wrong, the understood, as a matter of course, decisors regarding all those issues were always the chachamim of the time. I believe that's the case today as well. in halachic matters, of course they're not infallible. That's why there's a Masechta called Horios, which is all about what happens when the Sanhedrin makes a mistake and an error is discovered in a law that was rendered a certain way. Nor is anyone infallible, including Gedolim, regarding political issues or any other issues. Doctors are not infallible and lawyers are not infallible. The question isn't infallibility, the question is authority. Who is the authority? It's common to hear these days, and I don't think this is what Rabbi Golden was saying, but he can clarify it afterwards. It's commonly heard that the Arba Amos, the four cubits of halacha, are what the Chachamim of the generation are relegated to in their judgment. That's their territory. When it comes to extra halachic territory, then it is the experts, the self-declared or readily recognized by masses experts, whose judgment should be what carries the day. I don't believe that that's a Jewish attitude. Again, not saying infallibility, and not saying that expertise of the experts is not an important factor. As Rabbi Golden did articulate clearly, there's no question that a gadol or a posse cannot make a decision, whether it's a medical decision, giving someone a decision whether to take this therapy or this operation or not to operate. He can't do that without knowledge of medicine or a consultation with experts in the field. Same thing with politics, same thing in Israel with regarding military things. But when it comes down to the question of, after hearing the experts' opinions, if a posek or a gadol feels that he knows or he feels that he has a right to assert an opinion, what to do based on the information he got from the experts, the secular information, so to speak, but his own judgment of that information, that to me is what Das Torah is. And I think it applies just as much in the realm of secular things as it does in the world of halacha. The truth is that one of the most dear to me statements was made at the at a eulogy for Rav Chaim Ozer Grodzinski, and the quote goes as follows: the very same priest, or gadol, is what he meant, whose mind was suffused with the holiness of the Torah of Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Eliezer, etc., could also discern with the Holy Spirit the solution to all current political questions, to all worldly matters, to all ongoing current demands. And the person who said that was Rav Yoshe Ber Soloveitchik. So I think it's important to recognize that this is not just a right-wing opinion. Das Torah, whether it's called that or not, Emunas Chachamim, whether it's called that or not, recognizing that a Jew's ultimate authority is the Torah, and that the ultimate conduit of the Torah to the Jewish masses are the Gedolim of our time, that's an essential of Judaism, as I understand it. To go back to Rabbi Golden, I wasn't sure what the role of
I think we disagree here, actually.
Good.
I can clearly understand going back to a gadol in an area where, given the information, the decision that's to be made impacts upon the quality of Jewish life, impacts upon the quality of the Jewish community, impacts upon a decision that will affect us in a spiritual way. When someone this week, however, called me up and said, I have to decide whether or not to have a particular operation, can you find me a rabbi to speak to? My answer to her was, well, what do the doctors say? And that I believe that whether or not you have that operation is not to be decided by a rabbi. That decision is to be decided by your medical experts to determine whether or not you should have that surgery and whether or not it's in your best interest for health. I do not. And I would be very uncomfortable if she then came back to me and said, okay, I've spoken to the doctors. This is what they say. What do you think? And my answer would be, I think you should listen to the advice of the doctors. It's a recognition that in that area of life, a rav is not trained to make that medical decision, to make that personal decision. Let's go back to the issue for a moment. And again, I don't want you to make assumptions about my current political positions concerning Israel. But let's say for a moment we dealt with the question of, can you give back land? Rav Lichtenstein was saying to us at that point, I'm going to tell you, I'm going to render a halachic decision. My halachic decision is that you can do X, Y, Z if it will save Jewish lives. Now go out and talk to the experts about whether it will save Jewish lives. I don't want you coming back to me to ask me again once you get that decision. So I think we're differing here. I think what we're saying is that there are areas of life where I believe the Rav has to cede his decision-making power to those who are better trained to make that decision. And I think this will become a bit clearer later on when we talk about one of our other subjects, which is the issue of abuse in the Jewish community. And perhaps that will play a role in our discussion there as well.
Can I continue this?
Yeah.
I would only raise the issue, I don't agree, and I want to say that very clearly. I would raise the issue of the medical opinion with regard to end of life. The standard medical opinion is that a life that isn't lived to its fullest, meaning shooting hoops and going out to the theater, is a worthless life. And that is a medical opinion, and that keeping a person alive when he or she doesn't seem to have brain activity is that's a medical decision. And if one ceded that to a doctor, we would be murdering people right and left, according to all poskim. And I don't believe it's a medical decision. I don't think there's a gadol or a posek in the world who would say to someone who came to the person, to the posek, and said, this is the medical condition, should I have the operation? The operation is clearly assumed by all doctors to be proper. No one would say not to do it. There's a consensus. Where shalos come up are when it's not so clear, and this is the norm in medical things, I can tell you. I'm sure many of you know. There are always differences of opinion, even with regard to operate or not operate, this operation or that operation, this method or that method. And in those things, you're going to have different points of view. Now, each one carries a risk, and that's a shikul already. This risk against that gain, this gain against that risk. That's not a medical decision, because that has to do with what risk can a person take with his life for what ends. That's a halakhic decision. So I don't think that any gadol should be rendering medical decisions based on his knowledge of medicine. But I do believe that if a medical situation or a political situation comes down to, is this or is that the better course of action for me as a Jew who's concerned about Torah as my guide, that it's the posek and not the doctor whose word needs to be listened to.
I don't know if you want to ping-pong here, but... I think you have to clearly distinguish between two things, Rabbi Shaffron, that you said. End-of-life decisions, that's halachic. That is not just medical. No question about it. And how much time have I spent in my rabbinate dealing with people who are debating whether or not to continue treatment, not to continue treatment? And yes, under those conditions, that is a halachic concern. However, if someone comes back to me and says, I'm debating whether or not to have this surgery, and I've been told that the risks are X, and every doctor I speak to, or 9 doctors out of 10 that I speak to, tell me that it is in my best interest to have this surgery, then that to me is no longer a halachic decision.
It is. It's a halachic decision to follow the 9 out of 10 doctors, but if it's 5 against 5, that's a halachic decision.
I'm not sure.
I believe it is.
Okay, good.
Okay, maybe to, in a similar vein, try to accentuate a little bit what perhaps the differences might be, is as Rabbi Gold mentioned, the area of abuse, which we unfortunately, tragically, have been reading about sometimes on an almost daily basis of various issues that have come up. Abusers in the community, again, externally religious people who look like they're from, that they're very religious and they are doing unspeakable things to children. And we also, there are many allegations that there's been a cover-up in many of these incidents by some of the people who might be considered gedolim or have perhaps das Torah. So to put the question both in the general area but specifically in the issue of abuse, where there have been many calls from in certain areas that we go to a gadol first, that we don't go to, if there are allegations about a certain crimes of abuse, that we shouldn't go to the police right away. We should go to a a gadol, a rav, a respected rav, to ask him first. So I wanted you to respond. We'll start maybe with Rabbi Shafran to respond. What is your opinion on that? Is there a difference between abuse and other areas of crime? Do people go to rabbinical leaders when somebody breaks into their home and there's a question of whether we should report this or not? Is there? So if you can just touch upon that.
This is a very important topic, and I welcome the opportunity, even though I'm not here representing the Aguda. I'm not speaking for the Aguda, I'm speaking for myself. I do want to make reference to something that the Aguda has done over the past years that I think is speaks very much to this issue. Because it's been discovered over the past decade or more that the plague of abuse does not just exist outside the quote-unquote from world, but within it as well, and that there are people from all walks of life and all professions and all manners of dress who are serial abusers, that the Aguda sent someone to Eretz Yisrael to speak to the poskim about the particular question of mesira. There is a halacha, and it might not sit well with many of us, but it is a halacha, that one does not turn in another Jew to authorities where the person might be mistreated or incarcerated for a long period of time. Does mesira apply, was the question asked of these poskim, in cases where abuse is known to happen, and where you know that there's an abuser on the loose, and that the question is, should he be turned into the secular authorities because there's no way of controlling such a person otherwise? The answer to a person was that mesira does not apply in those cases. There is no, and likewise the same logic would apply to cases of drug dealing, dangerous drug dealing and things like that. Whenever there is a threat to others, the poskim said to a person, there is no, mesira is suspended, it doesn't apply there, because the greater good is served by having the person incarcerated even in any country, but certainly in a country like the United States where there's a due process and a fair trial. What was much distorted by the media and the impression left on many Jews' minds from the media is that the Aguda insisted that a gadol or a rav be consulted before doing this. What some of the poskim added to their tshuvot in this was that if a person knows of abuse, they weren't the suspension of mesira is obvious. If it's a suspicion or it's simply a report of abuse that has not been corroborated in any clear way, then it becomes something where you have to decide whether there's raglayim ledavar, which loosely translated means grounds for suspicion, reasonable grounds for suspicion. There are many secular laws, by the way, that have a very similar kind of a requirement with regard to reporting things and whatnot. Are there reasonable grounds for suspicion? The poskim, I think, because they realize that not everybody is, not every simple Jew like all of us will necessarily have the ability to make this shekel, strongly suggested that a rav of the person's choosing, a rav ideally, they said, with experience in this field, perhaps a social worker, perhaps someone who's simply been involved in this and knows the sugya, so to speak, knows the topic, be consulted first in cases where it's not clear knowledge to establish that there's raglayim ledavar, because mesira has been suspended, but it's still a halacha, and therefore one has to tread carefully here. I know personally of lives that have been ruined because of false accusations. It doesn't happen often, I'll admit to that, but I know of cases where it's happened. So there are, you know, fine Yiddish mamas who will jump to a conclusion, fine Yiddish tatas who will get outraged to report of something when perhaps the report was exaggerated or wasn't true. To avoid that whole realm of doubtfulness, they said, just run it by a rav. And again, a rav of your own choosing, a rav who's very sensitive to these matters. There are many such rabbanim here, one of them sitting next to me. And to go to such a person to say, this is what little Johnny told me happened to him here and there, I have no doubt that Rabbi Golden, and I think I would do the same thing, would consult perhaps with a social worker, see whether this fits a pattern of an abuser, whether it seems to make sense. And we don't need proof. All we need is raglayim ledavar. We have to be able to say, as a posek or as a rav, yes, I think there are raglayim ledavar. I think there are reasonable grounds for suspicion here. And at that moment, the person is not just allowed to, but obligated to go to the police and to see that the activity is investigated and stopped, if that's what is found out to be the case. Again, as I mentioned before, garb does not indicate righteousness, and even background doesn't indicate righteousness. There's a Gemara that is such a powerful statement about this. Talks about the Sar Shel Esav, who fought with Yaakov on the other side of the Nachal Yabok. And the Gemara says there's an argument between two Amoraim, I believe it is. One says, Nidmelo ketamid chacham. One says it looked like a Talmud Chacham. One says it looked like a listim, like a robber. It's interesting. One of them says that the Sar Shel Esav looked like a Talmud Chacham. That should be a warning to us all that looks don't matter, as they say in Shiduchim. It's the same thing true in life beyond that stage. Looks don't necessarily, and garb doesn't necessarily matter. Obviously, if a person's wearing a big cross around his neck, it might say something about his religious affiliation. If a person is dressed in a bad way, that might say something about his or her attitude toward style or toward tznius, whatever it might be. But in terms of frum dress, the bigger the yarmulke doesn't mean anything at all. So I welcome the opportunity to clarify what the position of poskim. And again, I'm going back to what I said when we talked about Das Torah. The bottom line here is poskim. If those poskim would have said that no, Mesira applies even in these cases, I would feel I'd have to swallow my own feelings and say, we can't turn in an abuser. We have to go to the next level and just try to keep surveillance on him. But that's not what they said. And since they didn't say that, that becomes to me Das Torah in this matter. And the Das Torah is bring the authorities in, but be careful before you jump to a conclusion. Make sure there's reasonable suspicion.
I must say that I'm very pleased to hear Rabbi Shaffron's words and a little bit surprised because, again, we seem to be very much in sync, but it was not my understanding of the Aguda's position until this point. And I know you're not representing the Aguda, but a number of years ago, two letters appeared in the New York, well, last year, I think, two letters appeared in the New York Times, which the Times placed side by side. One was a letter from me, and one was a letter from Rabbi David Zweibel, in which they were contrasting the Aguda's position with the RCA's position, and it was the RCA's position that someone with credible suspicion of abuse should go directly to the authorities. And as indicated in Rabbi Zweibel's letter, it was the Aguda's position that someone with that suspicion should first consult with the Rav. So I'm not quite sure if we misread or it was miswrote, but it is something that I think we need to comment on. Too often, the reaction of Rabbonim in situations of this type in the past years, and the world is changing as we discussed on the plane on the way here, has been to try to deal with issues of abuse in-house, to pass on the abuser somewhere else, to try to deal with it, to try. And this is true within the modern Orthodox community. It's true within the Haredi community 25 years ago, 30 years ago, 20 years ago. It was a different world, and that was the way it was dealt with. And it's wrong. It's wrong. For us to delay the reporting of abuse and add an additional step, which I believe will often turn out to be a step that causes the accuser not to go to the authorities, but to try to deal with this problem communally within the Jewish community, is something that I think is extremely damaging. It hasn't worked. We see that in community after community after community. Our position, and we use the same terminology, raglayim ledavar, credible suspicion, our position is that someone with a credible suspicion of abuse need not go to a rav. If that person wants to go to their rabbi and say, please come with me to the authorities, help me report this, then that's fine. But someone need not go to a rav. Someone should not stop it. Go. Someone should simply go to the authorities and report that abuse. Experts will tell you, as they've told us over and again, that except in tragic cases of divorce, it is extremely rare for an accusation of abuse to be false. It's extremely rare. Yes, it's true that the potential accused has rights, and we have to try to protect those rights, and we have to work within the system to do so, and we have to try to keep it out of the media until someone accused has been convicted, and it's very hard to do so. But we should be bending over backwards to help the victims and not to be so concerned about the potential perpetrators.
Okay, just to try to sum up and maybe accentuate a little bit more, Rabbi Shafran, you mentioned that if the psak from the Gedolim was that there is mesira in such a case, that you cannot report the alleged abusers, that you would swallow that whatever your thought was and submit your will to the Gedolim. Now, let me ask a two-part question then for Rabbi Golden as well. And again, I think we'll hopefully get to a clear answer of how we see Das Torah, especially in this case of abuse. What happens if at the same time there is a mandate to, if you have a mandate from the government to report such an allegation? The Gedolim say you can't do that. But if you don't and you're found out, you'll go to prison. Do you still submit your will to that? And then also the question in this case, what happens if by whether one should or should not have done this, one goes to two different Gedolim and give you two separate answers to that? How do you then balance this question of Das Torah with such a two separate answers?
Okay, I think that the first question, at least I'm familiar with New York law, Canadian law or outside of New York State. New York law says by mandated reporters that if there is a credible suspicion, very similar to the RCA statement, which I generously interpreted to mean that it's up to the person to make that decision, and if the person feels for religious or other reasons that he needs help in making that decision, whether by consulting a social worker or a psychologist or a rabbi with experience in these matters, that that's perfectly legitimate. And I believe that such a position would easily pass the smell test before any court that's objective in the state of New York. It's essentially the same thing. Credible is the key word here. Are we, each of us, should it be assumed that every person is capable of deciding whether something's credible or not? Or does it make sense to speak to a professional? If the professional were a social worker, I don't think anybody would have a problem. It's the fact that the professional here that's being suggested is a rav, again, a qualified rav, that's raising the issue of, well, what right does he have? To me, that bespeaks a very subtle but very dangerous attitude toward what a rav is. Now, not every rav is capable. Not every rav is smart. It's a fact. I've met a few. Not in this room, but I know that there are elsewhere. And therefore, I would not suggest that anyone go to such a rav to make a decision like this. But I can tell you one thing. If a report came to me about a suspected abuse, I would have no problem, and it wouldn't require more than a few minutes to pick up the phone or send an email or make a consult very quickly with a rav that I know is sensitive and knowledgeable about these matters. I think it's a red herring here to make this into some sort of a delay or a end run around reporting. It will not result in that if you go to the right rav. And which rav to go to, the Gedolim did not say. They left that decision to the individual. Each of us has our own rabbanim, and we choose them because we respect them. So I don't think anyone should be threatened by the fact that they, just like they run by a Hilchus Nida question or Hilchus Shabbos question by a Rav before acting on it, that they would run by a question of Mesira, which is a very serious issue in its own right, by a Rav. The second question you asked, I've already forgotten.
What happens if there's a clash? Oh, this goes to larger, so a clash between Gedolim. How do you, how does that fit into the concept?
Well, I mean, in this case, the essential approach, there wasn't a clash. As I say, to a person, they all took the same attitude. When it comes down to a clash that one will tell you report, one will tell you not report, that should never happen because you shouldn't go shopping. you should have a rav. Everyone, I say lach rav. If you had two rabbanim, I would ask one. I don't know what to say. I think one, a situation that can be avoided, and a challenging situation that can be avoided should be avoided. And I think you should pick one Rav and listen to what that one Rav says. And if he says that that's not credible, I mean, I think all of us have to have a certain amount of humility to admit to ourselves that maybe on occasion we might jump to conclusions. I know I do, all the time. And I don't think that it, you know, it says something bad about a person to admit that fact. I don't think in the real world that that will happen, though. What Rabbi Golden said before is so true. Years ago, it was a different world. I'm not going to say that anyone was wrong or anything. I'm not into judging people. Because it's a different time, and Ein L'dayin Ela Masha Ein Avro'os, a judge can only deal with what's in front of him. And at that time, the issue of abuse just wasn't in front of people. They didn't realize the extent of it. They didn't realize the damage it does. They didn't realize the recidivist aspect of it. None of this was recognized. Not in the firm world, not in the non-firm world, not in the non-Jewish world. It just there wasn't the sensitivity to it. Today there is. And I think that any Rav worth his salt would err in the direction of reporting and dealing with the situation in a very clear way today. And if anyone would not does not do that, I don't think he's worth his salt.
The only question that I have, and I, because as we continue to speak, I think our positions seem to coalesce except for one point. And that is, are you saying that someone who is credible, has credible suspicion, must go to a Rav? Or are you saying that someone who has credible suspicion has the right to go to a Rav? If you're saying that someone who has credible suspicion wants to go to his Rav and say, I need you to come with me, I'd like you to, I have this issue, then perhaps we can agree. If you're saying to me that someone who has credible suspicion of abuse, before reporting it, must consult with a Rav, that distinguishes our positions.
I think it does, and I believe that they should go to a Rav. And the word must is a strong word. It makes into a chiyuv. I don't know that that was the language of the tshuvos. As I understood them, it was more of a strong suggestion. But when a posek makes a strong suggestion, to me that's indicative of an achrayus, of the responsibility that we have. And again, it's not in the real world a setback to the cause, I don't think, of undermining abuse. And certainly we all hope for that goal.
Okay, we'll finish that topic. I just want to mention, if you can all look it up, Rav Eliashiv does have a written tshuva on this where he mentions the idea of reglaim the davar, credible evidence. I don't think in that tshuva he mentions anything about going to a Rav first. If we can all look that up. But all right, the next issue is really, I think, the burning issue perhaps the last couple of months since the new elections in Israel, the question of the new government and the new recommendations, pending legislation that will change the whole formula of the Haredi world in Israel in terms of learning, etc. We all hopefully know the general details without getting into them right now. The question is some of the reaction in the certain parts of the Orthodox world, without giving labels, there have been words bandied around against the position that things need to change, that the status quo cannot go on. Words used as Rishaim, evil people, Amalek, have been thrown around, Haman, for the people that are in the forefront of trying to change these laws, including rabbis, without Hamevin Yavin, with that as well. The question is I'd like to hear both of your views of what do you think should be the, what is the solution to find the Shvil HaZahav, the golden mean, the balance here between the their seeming lack of hakarat hatov, seeming that the fact that the Israeli government for the last over 60 years has given billions, literally billions of dollars to support Talmud Torah, there's never been unprecedented the amount of people learning full time. So on the one hand, the seeming lack of hakarat hatov, and now that there seems to be change in the air, this seeming vicious reaction to this, versus the understandable desire to learn Talmud Torah. So I'd like you to answer what your solution is that. Do you agree with some of these vicious attacks? Can the North American model work, where the Haredi, the people who learn full-time, are not supported by the government, and yet there are flourishing yeshivas in many different areas? So maybe Rabbi Golden first on this issue.
Okay. I'll make a couple of comments on this, and I'll try to do it in a structured fashion. There is no question at least to my mind, that Israel is facing a very serious social crisis and that the government of Israel is waking up to it at this point. The Haredi community, based upon statistics, and Rabbi Shaffer, and I may debate this, but these are the statistics that I have, 56% of the Haredi community in Israel is living in poverty, or is below the poverty line at this time. The employment rate over the last number of years for the Haredim has risen by 5%, which means that within the Haredi community, 40 to 45% of the men are now working, and 56 to 61% of the women are. The Haredi community is the largest growing community within the state of Israel, and there is an expectation based upon the projections that that community will triple in 50 years. I don't know how the state of Israel can continue to bear this reality on an ongoing basis. We are, now let me go to that's one piece. Let's talk about attitudes for a moment. There is no question, and again, I'll quote something that Rabbi Shaffer and I spoke about before. It's hard to be passionate about moderation. Moderation doesn't seem to exist in the Israeli society. On the left, the Chilonim have a growing, many of them have a growing hatred of religion and the religious community. But, and here I will accept some of the blame upon the Dati Tzioni community as well as the Haredi community. Much of the attention of the Dati Tzioni community has been dealing with issues that are not socially concerning to the main body politic. They've been dealing with the settlements, they've been dealing with land. The Rabbanut has alienated, both when it was under the Dati Tzioni Shulton, and now I believe since it has been under the Haredi Shulton, it has alienated the vast majority of Israelis who are not religious, because the only association they have with religion is when they get married, and then when they get married, the process is grueling and demeaning. When they get divorced, the process can be grueling and demeaning. There is a growing anger from both sides that threatens to rip the Israeli society apart. Now, it's easy to point fingers, and I'm going to point a couple. I was in Israel recently for Yom HaZikaron. I stood on a bridge, and the siren sounded, and everyone stopped until a gentleman in what I would just call Haredi garb kept driving his bicycle through the street. Now, I'm not going to blame the entire Haredi community upon the actions of that one gentleman. But what are the attitudinal projections that the average Israeli receives from the Dati community? I'm going to be revolutionary here for a minute. I don't expect the Haredi synagogues to say the Tefillah L'Shom Hamdina. I can live with that. But what about the Tefillah for Tzahal? Amisha Berach. In my synagogue in America, in addition to the Misha Berach for Tzahal, in addition to the Tefillah L'Shom Hamdina, we say a Misha Berach for the American soldiers. And in my synagogue, we read the names of every American soldier who died that past week in Afghanistan. Because I want my congregants to know that there are individuals who have made the ultimate sacrifice for their safety. Now, why is it that we can't have that same Hakarat HaTov from every shul throughout the world? Well, take that back. Satmar, Turekarta, I understand. But even those synagogues that will say we're not anti-Israel, we're not necessarily in favor of the government, but we're not anti-Israel. Why can't there be an element of Hakarat HaTov? And would not that element of Hakarat HaTov go a long way in perhaps, and I would then expect the Chilonim to make their moves towards the center as well, towards repairing these rifts? So therefore, that's the backdrop against which I, and we could talk about this for hours, the backdrop against which we are operating. It is a frightening backdrop. Against that backdrop, you have a government that is now making some very difficult decisions. Personally, I think they may be moving too fast. And here again, moderation is called for. A very beautiful article that I read recently said there should be moderates. Well, that's why it's such a beautiful article, because it's a dream. Moderates from the Haredi community and moderates from the Chiloni community sit down and try to come up with a plan. Sit down and try to say, okay, we got this problem. We don't want the Haredi community to continue to live in poverty. We don't want this rift to continue to grow. We don't want the Chilonim to hate religion. Let's figure it out. It's a dream. But take my word for it. From my perspective, something has to happen. Because if it doesn't, I don't know the solutions.
This is a multi-pronged and very serious and complex topic. I'm going to take a stab at it, but there's no way I can possibly cover all the aspects. I'd like to make one basic point, though. The picture that was just painted is the glass half-empty one. There's a glass half-full one also that I'm not in Israel, so I don't claim to know it firsthand. But any one of us can go and look at the writings of my good friend Jonathan Rosenblum, who is has applied himself to describing all the good and wonderful things that Haredi organizations and individuals do in Israel that are recognized by many of the non-Haredi community, and realize that it's not just the boar on the bicycle that is in the imagination of Israelis or in the experience of Israelis, but that there are also hospitals and homes for sick children and Chesed organizations that minister to both Haredi and non-Haredi Jews who are in the consciousness of Israelis also. So I don't think that everything is negative. There is, to be sure, a problem with the structure of the Rabbanut's delivery of services, so to speak. But to me, the answer to that is to simply be mitaken the system of how that's done. I don't know how to do that. I don't profess to be an expert on it. But I think there it's the system that's the problem, not so much the fact that these are visibly observant Jews delivering the services. It's more that the bureaucracy needs to be streamlined. It's an extremely important thing. Hakarat HaTov is a theme that I sound right and left. To me, it's the essence of Jewish philosophy. You have it in the very beginning of history when the grasses won't grow until there's an Adam to be makir b'tovasim shel gishomim. I can literally speak for an hour or two about the importance of Hakarat HaTov and tell you stories that would enthrall you, because it's a topic very dear to my heart. And I do believe that there has to be Hakarat HaTov even for people that weren't trying to help you but ended up helping you. Even if they tried to harm you and helped you in the end, you have to have Hakarat HaTov to them. An inanimate object is the object of Hakarat HaTov in the Torah. Moshe is not supposed to hit the water in Mitzrayim. Aaron has to do it because the water helped Moshe and the earth helped Moshe hide the body of the Egyptian that he killed. He can't hit an inanimate object. It's a it's for us. It's not for the person that we're makir tov to. So I do believe that kal v'chomer, all the more so when it comes to what the state of Israel has provided, for whatever its intentions or its founder's intentions, has provided the Torah observant and Torah dedicated world, that Hakaret HaTov belongs there. I would also say, though, that it works both ways. And this is where there's a dearth, unbelievable dearth, of Hakaret HaTov in the other direction. We Charedim, and I believe that we Orthodox Jews who are not Charedim, who don't identify with that community, deep down, all of us recognize that the power of Torah is a protection for the Jewish people. And therefore, in Israel, you might think otherwise. The Gemara says it. I accept the Gemara. It says that a Talmud Chacham doesn't have to pay the city protection tax because his study is his contribution to the protection of the city. And whether you or I accept this or not, I do accept it. The bottom line is that this is the actual belief of Haredi Jews in Israel. They really believe it. It's not an excuse, as some people claim. It's not an invented concept, as others claim. It is... What, I'm sorry? What?
Yeah, well, yeah, well,
I'm okay. not sure how that...
Yeah, well, we'll get the questions afterwards. Mm-hmm.
Same place he is anytime. This concept of Hakaret HaTov for the full-time Torah studiers is totally absent. If this were a Chiloni Israeli crowd, I would exhort you to go out and express that Hakaret HaTov and be amazing what might happen in response. But that's not there either. So I think that one can't just go to one side and say, you are not being sufficiently Makir Tov. All I can say is Hakaret HaTov all around. We order around for everybody of Hakaret HaTov. But there's another concept here, which is also a very important one, which is that you have to try to empathize with another person's point of view, another person's different point of view. This is something that is, to me, the most essential thing when you get into an argument with someone and you want to keep it not personal, but you want to make it an argument about things. I used to have a sign up in my bedroom that said, great people discuss ideas, and mediocre people discuss things, and little people discuss other people. So moving arguments away from the personal and even the communities and looking just at issues and ideas, it is so important for each of us to try to get into the skin of the other. The other might be an atheist. The other might be a Reform Jew. The other might be an animal rights activist, whatever it might be. If one wants to interact with that person meaningfully, one has to try to understand where the person's coming from. This is not an easy thing. It took me many years to learn even the degree of doing it that I'm able to do today, but it's a much greater degree than I once was capable of. I think that all of us, myself included, are only imperfectly able to understand the Haredi attitude in Israel. They do believe they are holding up the safety of the state. You can agree, disagree, but that's their belief. Understand where that's where they're coming from. They also believe that whether it's the army or it's other issues in Israel that are being pressed at present, or the Kosovo, whatever it might be, that they are the objects of a social engineering experiment. And it's hard to argue this with them, if you're inclined to argue it, because here they are just doing the same old thing they've been doing for half a century. And all of a sudden, all these things are changing. 15 years ago, the child allowances were cut drastically. A few years after that, cut more. Now they're being cut even more drastically, which is why the poverty level is what it is. And of course, none of us want a welfare state, but there's nothing necessarily wrong with a welfare state, especially a Jewish welfare state supporting Torah. This is their attitude. We have to try to empathize and at least understand that they're coming from that place. And that place involves a bunch of things that we don't normally think about much. They feel put upon. They think they're being assaulted right and left. All of a sudden, you have to go to the army. You have to become an Israeli. You have to be forced to enter the workforce. A thought experiment. Can you imagine if the United States government suddenly decreed that every man and woman, every father and mother has to work because the economic situation requires it, the American economy needs it, and a mother says, I want to stay home with my child. I want my husband to work. Or vice versa. The husband says, I want to stay home with my child. I want my wife to work. We want to raise our children ourselves, not with a nanny. Can you imagine the hue and cry that would come from such an edict from the American government? We would say, our children are more important than the economy, air quotes. Well, that's how Haredim look at what's happening in Israel. Torah is more important than the economy to them. I'm not saying you have to agree. I'm not even saying I agree. I'm saying that's what they believe. And we have to understand that they're coming from that place and not demonize them or vilify them because we don't agree with them. It's a very important thing. We have to recognize that they're not coming from a crazy place. They believe, and there's some truth to this, I believe, that there is a move to change them, to engineer their social structure along a new model. And they won't do that. Getting to the world of reality, they won't do that means that the push to make them do that is only going to get a pushback. If I were a Chiloni, and a wise one, I would say that this is not the way to do it. The way to do it is what's been happening over the years, which is little by little, opportunities offered to them. There's been a lot of growth in that realm. Rabbi Golden alluded to some of it. Make it a little bit easier for them to enter the workforce. Make it easier. Take away the stigma of being in the army, and you'll get a few people, and eventually it'll be less charged of an atmosphere. Unfortunately, the current Israeli government is not taking that tack for whatever reason. Some say because they want to take the pressure off of itself, off of the decisions they're making that impact the middle class. Others say it's because of their ideals. Either way, I believe it's a really, really bad move, and I'm not the only one who says that. There are people in the Chiloni community who say the same thing. So as I say, it's a complex subject, but I do believe that Hakarat HaTov in both directions, and I'm trying to understand the other, and they're too in both directions, and I say this to Haredim all the time. Get into that mind, get into the head, get under the skin of someone who's different from you. And you'll be amazed what you find. You won't agree with them, hopefully, but you will understand them, and you won't hate them. And that's really what the goal should be.
The golden, yeah, 2 minute response.
2 minutes. I agree with a tremendous amount that you said. I believe that understanding the other is critical to any kind of solution. I disagree with a few things that you said, and I'll just say them very quickly and then perhaps raise a question that really lies at the root of so much of this. Firstly, you said that the issue of the Rabbanut is an issue of services and how those services are delivered. As someone who has had to interface with the Rabbanut on issues of Geirut and other areas, it is not simply an issue of services. It's an attitudinal issue. It's an issue of whether or not those who are involved with the Rabbanut feel that there is legitimacy to other Rabbanim within the Orthodox community and to others within Israeli society and how that they are dealt with. So I think it's much more than simply a systemic issue. Number two, when you say that there's a perception that all of a sudden the government wants to social engineer a change, I believe there may be some truth to the social engineering accusation, but it's not all of a sudden. There is a building up of a problem, of an issue that has continued to grow and continues to exist. And I understand that many, I don't believe all the Haredim, having been in Israel often and interfaced with the community and seeing some of the internal problems of those young people who ostensibly are learning but are not learning and what percentage are actually setting their mind to the learning, these are issues that really need to be addressed within the Orthodox, within the Haredi community, which brings me to my last point. And here I'm fairly certain that we will disagree. And that is, I wonder, and I'm more than wonder, whether the model of Israeli society was ever meant to be, the model of Jewish society, and I can bring quotes, but we're running late at this point, was ever meant to be that 100% of the possible young men who can sit and learn should sit and learn, or whether or not Kollel was meant for the best and brightest, for a unique number of people within the community, and that the support of those individuals should be coming from their own community as much as it should be coming from others as well. We are trying to sustain a situation, sometimes here in America, but certainly in Israel, which I do not believe was the traditional model that was meant to be. learning. Can I have 1 minute? I'm going to read a quote. An individual should make his Torah study primary and his livelihood secondary. He should work as much as necessary each day to provide for his basic needs, and the remainder of the day and night should be occupied with the study of Torah. It is considered a great attribute for a person to sustain himself through the work of his hands, and anyone who decides to occupy himself in Torah study, not to work, and to sustain himself through charitable funds, desecrate God's name and demeans the Torah. Any Torah study that is not accompanied by work leads to sin and is certain to result in theft from the community. That was a statement from Rav Moshe Isserles in his glass to Rabbi Yosef Karo Shulchan Aruch.
The Rambam says much the same. This takes us back to the issue of Das Torah, I believe, because applying even the Ramo's statements to a situation that he didn't foresee and that he couldn't have foreseen, new times, they're gedolim in each generation. Chachmei kol dor v'dor is, again, the essence of what Emunas Chachamim is. And I believe that today we have only the gedolim of our time, that the dayanim that are bayamim ha'heim in our days, to look to toward what model is necessary for the particular challenges of our particular times. Kolel, whether in America or whether in Israel, whatever model it might be, is considered to be an important thing. And I could easily adopt the simple meaning of what the Rama wrote and take it on in my life. I have children who are studying Torah full-time and children who are working full-time. So I have an air traffic controller son-in-law. I have a businessman son-in-law. So I have nothing, and these are people I love and believe are dedicated to Yiddishkeit as much as anybody I know. So I don't have an inherent problem with a person working. But those who do, and those who make the communal norms for a community, like the Gedolim have to do, have to be respected for their judgments and not have sources that are hundreds of years old presented to them as if to say that this is applied today the same way it was applied in Poland in the 16th century.
I have a lot to say, but I won't.
Right. There's a lot to say on this. We could clearly spend hours on this issue. We also wanted to discuss in a more substantive form the questions of women's leadership, what the roles of women are, limitations on that, as well as we've been talking mostly about issues within the Orthodox world. We also want to discuss questions about how we should deal with the Reform conservative movements and totally unaffiliated Jews. Are we missing the boat? Do we need a new paradigm and how to respond to that? So because of the time, though, we're not going to specifically ask those questions to the rabbis now, but we want to open up the forum to questions. You can ask on those or any other issues and let us know if you're specifically asking towards one of the rabbis or to both of them. So maybe just come up and stand up and and go, Dr. Sturm. Yeah.
Shh. Is there any place that you feel that there isn't a place for Das Torah? Are there any limitations in Das Torah in this situation?
Not the way that I described it. In other words, when you're talking about guidance regarding an issue, and all the information regarding the judgment has been supplied to the Gadol, I do believe that. That the Gadol's word is what we should follow.
Both in the community and in the personal life.
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay, you can just come to the mic. If.
Thank you for the remarks. My question is directed to Rav Shafran, and it stems from what is the attitude to somebody who does not believe in Das Torah, in their acceptance in what the Rav would consider to be the firm world. And I point out an incident that happened here in Toronto several years ago where there was one of the Gedolim came to Toronto and was hosted by a Gudda of Toronto, and they invited all the Orthodox school kids to hear the Gudol. And there was a great publication of the fact there was an achdus of all the different schools that came to Yerogadol, except the one school, Orthodox school, was not invited. It was the modern Orthodox school. And when I approached a spokesperson from Agada as to why, he says, because they don't believe in Das Torah, so they were excluded. So I asked the Rav to respond.
I can't respond to that particular anecdote because I'm just not familiar with it and wouldn't know what other factors may have gone into that. I just can't comment on it. In general, though, your question is, what is the attitude of a person who is committed to Das Torah to someone who isn't? A fellow Jew, that's all. I think if such a person is mistaken, I would not marginalize, personally, any such person. I have great respect for people that I don't agree with in many things, even in fundamental things. I have friends that would shock you to know that they are my friends. I have friends who are non-Orthodox clergy people. I have friends who are atheists. I have friends who are ardent feminists. I disagree with them. I think they're wrong, and I'll argue with them. But my attitude toward them, over and above all, is that they're my friends. That's all I can tell you.
Would you allow them to daven in your shul?
Yeah, 100%.
I could probably ask a question on everything you said, every word, every nakuda, like a Rashi, I could be Vedayak, but I'm just going to take the last thing. You believe in Das Torah, at the same time you believe that you've got to be cordial to the modern Orthodox, invite them to your shul, and whatever else you may have just said. So let me give you some Das Torah. Rav Schneer Kotler, he wouldn't have done that. Rav Malkiel Kotler, at a Shalashuddha said at a Gudda, in Flatbush, I think Avenue J, said, the greatest threat to Judaism is modern Orthodoxy. He's a Gadol, right? He's Das Torah. Am I right on that part so far?
He's a Gadol, yes.
And he's Das Torah.
He is a Das Torah.
Okay.
Correct.
Rabbi Shlomo Miller, Das Torah, he's a Gadol. Mishpacha Magazine, the greatest threat to Judaism. Mm. You can figure out the rest of it. Even Rav Steinman, a moderate, said that. Now, you're bound by Das Torah. Do you believe in this Das Torah?
Mm-hmm. I believe that that is a perfectly valid philosophical, theological statement to make if
you
understand.
You abide by that.
What do you mean by abide by it? Do I think it's a threat?
You have to honor Das Torah.
I honor Das Torah in the sense that I know that expression of about an idea, not a person. They're not talking about people.
When they say
about orthodoxy, they're saying an attitude. The attitude that they're referring to is the attitude of the women of the wall. The attitude.
They're not talking about women of the wall. Those are Orthodox Jews.
Just let them answer that.
I don't think you can assume you know who they mean or what movement they mean or what philosophy they mean by the term modern Orthodox. Today, what we used to call modern Orthodox have a different title, centrist Orthodox. So it's a moving target, and I don't think you have a right to assume that any of the Gedolim whom you mentioned are referring to something that they don't have a right to refer to that way.
Okay.
And I believe that they feel what the Gemara says, mina machriva, the closer something is to something else, the more harm it can do to it. And if they believe that a certain attitude that people characterize as modern Orthodoxy is a threat to the Jewish community as a whole or to their understanding of what Torah is, they're perfectly allowed to make that statement, and it shouldn't be taken offense at.
And I assume that you agree with that statement, not as against the person, but as an idea.
If I heard that statement, I would go to the Gadol and I would say to him, what did you mean, Rav, by modern Orthodoxy? And if they described it to me, I would accept it, because I think what they would describe to me would not be a person who says the tefillah for the Shalom of the Medina. I don't think they meant that. You can ask them. Did you ask them?
I wouldn't.
You
bother.
Should.
I
no,
wouldn't bother.
All right, that's a problem. That's a problem.
One last question.
To not care about another Jew enough that you won't even ask him what he meant is a problem.
Just a quick question.
You said you're all for. When the question was asked about the bracha for the Medina and Hakar Satov, you went on eloquently about how important it is to have Hakar Satov, but you refused or refrained from answering the question, why don't the yeshiva world, why don't your synagogues, why doesn't Agudah have the bracha for the Medina? Not the Medina, sorry, for Tzahal. That you refused to answer.
Okay, should I answer it now?
Yeah.
Please.
Yeah.
Am I allowed to?
Yeah, go ahead, yeah.
In the
okay.
I'm sure you have many.
All right, so.
I'm sure you have many.
It's a lot of room for dialogue for the future. Let's get to the answer, though.
In the Agudah Shul in which I happen to daven in Staten Island, the tefillah for the Chayalim is said every Shabbos. That's number one. Number two, I fully understand why the shuls that choose not to say it don't say it. And it's not because they don't care about the Chayalim. They are concerned about Israel and all of its soldiers and all of its citizens every bit as much as a person who sings the tefillah from the rooftops. I know that because I know the people. The reason they don't say it is a very simple one, and it's not one that will sit well with some of you, perhaps, but that's their reason. Any tefillah that was created by a entity that was established by a non-religious entity, what I mean here is the original Rabbanut of Israel, which was established by the State of Israel, which was a secular democracy, that carries in the minds of many Haredim a shemit, a stain of illegitimacy. They won't be cowed into reciting words that were created today by a particular, what they perceive as a political group. Do I personally have a problem with it? That's not the issue. The issue is that their motivation is not intended to be an insult. It's intended to be a self-protective measure. And
All right.
Because traditionally it wasn't a state that identified the leader, the religious leaders of the Jewish people.
Okay,
Rabbi Golden wants to say something. Yeah.
Right. It's very clear to me that most of the questions are going to come to Rabbi Shapran, so I'm getting upset here. So I just want to say two things. Number one, I think that Rabbi Shapran has presented a very cogent and coherent presentation and does not deserve to be.
No, okay.
Does not deserve to be attacked, but certainly questioning is appropriate. Second of all, as easy it is for us to attack others, I'm just going to simply say that we within the modern Orthodox community have our very, very serious challenges as well. This is not our topic, but I think I need to say it because I'm hearing it's so easy to attack other people. I want you to think about the challenges that we're facing as well. And I'll raise just two or three. Number one, we could learn a great deal from the passion of the Haredi community. My modern Orthodox shul struggles with tefillah. 90% of the people are talking while the davening is going on. They're not davening. Walk into a Haredi shul or many Haredi shuls, that does not happen. We need to be passionate about what we're doing.
I wish you were right.
Right. Well, then I have a rosy dream of the Haredi community. Baruch Hashem. All right. When you talk about modern Orthodoxy, I'll tell you one other thing. And that is, it's often been said there are a lot of modern Orthodox rabbis. There aren't that many modern Orthodox Jews. For many, many modern Orthodox Jews, modern Orthodoxy is a compromise. It's not a philosophy. One day, maybe we'll sit and talk about what the philosophy of modern Orthodoxy is, and you'll be surprised. I believe it's a lot harder of a life than it is in many ways than the Haredi life is. It means to be totally committed to halacha, and at the same time to recognize that there may be things that you can learn from an outside world, and to walk that line. It doesn't mean to say I'm modern Orthodox because I'm not Lakewood. And for many, many modern Orthodox people, that's what we say. So I just, as we're challenging the Aguda community, I would urge you that we should be challenging ourselves as well.
All right, take the last question, and then we'll just have a very brief sum up. Yeah.
Okay. I guess the topic of the evening was how can we get along better? And, you know, we've had interesting questions asked where you disagree about things, and you know, I guess to me, like, how can we get along better? I mean, I heard about Hakarat HaTov and that stuff, and it all sounds good, but you know, living here in Toronto, you know, I think sometimes about, you know, whether we should be doing something different in the schools with the kids, whether everybody should be making, you know, and it's not to anything on the Haredi community, but like something like the Walk for Israel. Why can't everybody, you know, muster it up one day a year or come for Yom HaZikaron and Yom HaAtzma'ut? Like, you know, try and find things where people can get together a little bit better?
I think that finding things to do, it's often done. This is the standard approach to shalom, is to let's find something we can all do together. I don't believe that that's the solution. I think the solution to our problems as a community and our lack of respect that sometimes bubbles up lies in what I talked about before, which is getting into the skin of the other. I don't think anyone should be ashamed of who he or she has decided, the way he or she has decided to live, or what shul he or she has decided to affiliate with. But I do think that we need to teach our children to respect, if not agree with, respect the other, whether that other is someone who's close to us on the spectrum or even far from us on the spectrum, whether it's the political spectrum, the social spectrum, or even the Orthodox spectrum, for that matter, the Jewish spectrum. To me, that is a solution, not finding a place where we can all cheer at the same time. That's an ephemeral kind of unity. True unity comes from empathy. And empathy means recognizing that, as the Gemara says, just as no two faces are the same, so are no two minds the same. People think differently. And the Kutzker Rebbe said about that, can you imagine hating someone for looking differently than you look? Think about that. You don't hate someone because he has a longer nose or she has blonder hair than you, hopefully not. You look at somebody as different. They're that way. Well, our attitudes are also, many of them at least, ingrained in us as individuals, and we have to be just as forgiving and just as understanding and just as empathetic with regard to a person's inside their head as what their faces look like. So to me, that's the answer to the question, is we don't have to all do the same thing. We don't have to be the same. We don't have to have the same exact theology or philosophy. What we have to do is have the same empathy, each of us in the direction of the others. Okay, I hear what you're saying.
And I would argue that an evening like this is a first step towards what you're talking about. In other words, simply trying to find things that we'll do together, we'll probably be very frustrated by that, because there are some things we'll do together, but lots that we won't. But sitting down and talking to each other, Rabbi Shaffin's willingness to come to, I didn't know it was going to be this way, but to a modern Orthodox, to what is a modern Orthodox mainly crowd, is something that I think is courageous and deserves to be respected. And I think that our ability and our willingness to talk to each other is something that has to be encouraged. And maybe that way we'll begin to understand each other better. It is exactly. That's an issue. Right. All right. I don't know you. I don't know what you are.
All right. As we can see, there is a lot more to talk about. And maybe just picking up on the points that were just raised now, is that we'll invite you back soon, next year. It doesn't have to wait till next year.
If we can
bring along people from all parts of the community and we can really have a dialogue. Mm-hmm. There's a lot. We're going to, again, get to many other issues. We want to really have a summing up here, but we also recognize it's late and we have to have Marv.
But this young lady's been waiting, so...
Oh, there is? Okay. One last question.
One question to both rabbis. Is there a halachic distinction between Ahava Yisrael and Sinat, and the prohibition of Sinat Hinam between one Torah observant Jew and another, as between a Torah a Torah observant Jew is supposed to do halakhically with a non Torah observant Jew? Are the obligations different of Ahava Yisrael and Sinat Hinam, or are they exactly the same?
They're exactly the same, as far as I know.
Me too.
That was an easy one.
Okay, so like I said, we hope that we'll in the near future we can continue this really all parts of the community. My brother's just going to finish up in 1 second.
Okay, thank you very much. Of course, you know I'm a big believer in discussion, and we will be continuing, and I want to thank you for coming, and I think the passion at the end is good. Arguing some... It's... there is much to be said. I agree with, you know, Rabbi Golden, that one of the weaknesses in our community, in the modern Orthodox, you know, community, is often our lack of passion. So if we can channel our passion towards coming here together, that's a wonderful thing. And I want to thank our speakers and my brother and my sister. And we should have only simchas, and we should try, you know, peace among Jews is the most important thing. That's nothing else to say. Now, we have yard site. We're going to make a Mari Lemini here, but Aaron Weinstock also has yard site. So if we can get at least 9 volunteers with 9 men volunteers with Mr. Weinstock to go in a small bake meets rush. We'll dive in here 2 minutes and make sure we have a minion. So we'll have 2 minyanim for Mari. But that's okay.